This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, first responders from across the state mobilised and headed for the Panhandle to help with the recovery effort. The damage to homes, power, communication and infrastructure from the Category 4 hurricane with its powerful storm surge and destructive winds means there's a hard road ahead to rebuild. We'll hear from some of the first responders on the front lines and we want to hear from you. What do you want to know about the recovery effort and how Central Floridians can help the Panhandle rebuild after the storm? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Send us your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. With us in the studio, Greg Higgison. He is the Vice President of Development with Second Harvest. Thank you so much for joining us, Greg.
Yeah, good morning, Matthew.
Joining us also by phone from the Panhandle Orange County Fire Rescue Chief Michael Vida. Thank you for joining us, Chief.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Verizon Public Relations Manager for the Southeast, Kate J. Kate, thank you as well.
Good morning and thank you.
So you can join the conversation too. Our phones are actually out as it happens at the moment, but send us a tweet. We'd love to hear from you. Questions and comments on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Chief Vida, I want to start with you. Give us a sense of where you are and what it looks like on the ground up there. I mean, some of the photographs of the destruction from the storm are pretty extraordinary. So what are you seeing?
Sure. So I'm currently in Tallahassee at the state EOC. Tallahassee actually looks very good. They've done an incredible job of cleaning up storm debris. As we head west into Gadsden County and some of the other more impacted counties, you can see trees that are down, road signs that have been completely knocked over. And you're beginning to see signs of the recovery as roads open up. Chainsaw crews have come through and begun to bring things back into normalcy. Our teams that are working in the heavily impacted areas basically report that it looks as if a bomb went off. Every building down to the foundation, not a tree left standing. Some of our crews talk about houses in the roadway, boats that have been washed hundreds of feet inland, and trees that are still standing but about 15 feet up have been completely snapped off as if a giant lawnmower had come through and just ripped them apart. So as you get to ground zero, just really complete devastation.
And we can hear some of the chatter going on in the background in the EOC. It sounds like things are still pretty busy. Is it still kind of completely staffed up, and will it be so for some time, just given the scale of the destruction?
Yes. Yeah, so here in the EOC, and you're right, it is very busy here. We are fully staffed, and there are a lot of things going on, a lot of support for the impacted citizens in the area. And, this will be a long-term recovery. So certainly for the next several weeks, it'll be extremely active, but we're talking about years to help these communities get back on their feet.
What about the commitment from Orange County Fire Rescue and across the state? I understand it's a lot more than you would have in maybe previous storms in recent memory in the last decade or so. So give me a sense of how many first responders from across the state and from Orange County specifically are up there helping out at the moment.
So specifically from Orange County Fire Rescue, we have two engine companies and a strike team leader, an incident commander, that's helping to lead one of the 12 engine strike teams that are out there. To give everybody a sense, an engine strike team is five fire engines and a chief officer that's over them. And there's currently 12 of those deployed to the area. That is an incredible amount of resources. You're talking 60 fire engines with four-person crews. In addition to those, we have six ambulance strike teams, and then what are called six tender strike teams, which essentially are large water tankers that are replacing the fire hydrant systems that are not operational in the area. So It is a massive, massive effort, hundreds of first responders just from throughout Florida and thousands from throughout the country.
And what's the role? Because I read that the search and rescue teams essentially finished their kind of urban search and rescue work this week. What's the primary responsibility of first responders that you're overseeing up there at the moment?
So we're still continuing to open roadways to deal with structures that are collapsed. There's still a lot of work in supporting citizens who don't have power, don't have access to food and water. So those types of distributions are going on. We're here as first responders to care for the citizens. So some of the things we're starting to see now are chainsaw injuries, people falling off of roofs, people being seriously injured by falling trees and debris as they try to clear their properties. We've had some heat-related injuries as folks are working outside and they don't have access to air conditioning and sometimes water. So a lot of that kind of support going on now.
Mm-hmm. And Chief Vida, I guess, you know, the storm of this magnitude, a lot of the first responders in those counties most affected, like Bay County, for example, they must have suffered some damage to their own homes, I imagine. So how do they cope with, you know, trying to go out there and do their job in amongst that destruction that might be affecting them personally too?
Yeah, there really are some touching stories. Our initial teams, as they first made their way through, as the storm winds were still subsiding, they were encountering first responders, firefighters, police officers, paramedics who had been on the front line for several days. And either didn't know how their own families and property had fared or knew already that they lost everything, and yet they were out there continuing to serve the community. And those stories continue to come in. So I think it is important to remember that these first responders are embedded in these communities. They live here, and they also have been impacted.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Chief Michael Vida from the land of the Orange County Fire Rescue, rather. He's up helping coordinate the response at the EOC in Tallahassee to the Hurricane Michael. Stay with us, Chief Vida. I want to bring in Kate Jay now. She is with Verizon. And Kate, you were posting some pretty stunning photographs on Twitter earlier this week showing the extent of the damage to some of those cell sites. And we have been hearing stories of the struggle it's been to try and get cell service up and running, because that is something that people obviously need. They need that communication, that method of communication. What are you seeing, and what are you hearing from the teams on the ground from Verizon up there?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, we all rely on our, you know, on our wireless devices when the sun is shining and everything is, you know, operating as it should be. Certainly that connectivity is never more important for both, you know, customers who want to connect with their friends, family, and loved ones, and the first responders on the ground doing that work that, you know, that we've just heard about. So, I mean, as we all know, this was an unprecedented storm, and our crews on the ground, what we've experienced, obviously a number of issues that were that we have been dealing with on the ground, but the biggest one was an unprecedented number of fiber cuts to a key ring, which really provides that connectivity for you know, Panama City Beach, and those surrounding areas.
When you say a key ring, you mean like the kind of network of fiber cable that is connecting those cities?
Yes, that's correct. And that fiber provides the connectivity to each cell site in the area. So it's really, we need that fiber to make all of our cell sites work. That's both the permanent one and the permanent ones, and then those temporary ones that we may, you know, that we typically bring in. We stage those before a storm so that we can deploy those if we do have damage to our cell sites. So just to give you a little bit of context, so in the first 2 days after the storm, our fiber teams had repaired 45 fiber cuts and laid 5 kilometers of new fiber. By the time that new fiber was laid, there were already 9 new cuts in it. So, you know, it's just the work that has been happening since, you know, shortly after, as soon as we could get into the damaged areas, it was safe to do so, and we were able to gain that access and worked with, you know, state and local officials to get help with that. You know, we've been making progress, but it's a challenging situation there on the ground. But our teams have been working 24/7 because, again, we understand how critically important that connectivity is. And, you know, we've made significant progress, particularly this week, but we're not going to rest until, you know, we're back to 100%.
And there has been a bit of criticism, right? I mean, the state officials have said essentially this needs to happen faster. Do you think that's fair, or do you kind of get the sense that you have the resources in place to get things done as quickly as possible?
No, it's fair. I mean, we have built our brand on reliability. We have for years provided reliable service, and certainly we did not live up to those expectations. And we've heard from our customers, and that includes, you know, first responders, state, local, you know, officials, and we understand that. Again, this, you know, the extent of damage that we saw to our fiber network, you know, it's been, you know, we are doing everything we can to get that fixed. It's just been, you know, quite a bit of a challenge. But yes, I mean, we pride ourselves on providing that reliable service and being able to get back up quickly. And we didn't do that in this instance. And, you know, our first priority right now is getting everything back to 100%, right? We want that network to be back to 100%. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we are looking at, you know, our network and how we can make improvements to ensure this doesn't happen again. And then, of course, you know, we're looking to, you know, how we can support customers and the community as a whole, because we're in this with the community. Yesterday, or in the last 2 days, we've announced 3 months free service for both businesses and consumers in the 9 hardest hit counties. And we've also announced $500,000 to the American Red Cross and $500,000 to the Florida Disaster Relief Fund. So, again, we're in this with the communities. We'll work to, you know, rebuild the trust of our customers and hope to earn them back one by one. And, you know, we look forward to being a part of the community as they rebuild.
Yeah. KJ, thank you so much for joining us from Verizon there. And good luck with the rest of getting things up and running. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I want to bring I want to bring Greg Higgison into the conversation now. Greg Higgison is with Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida. This is kind of an unprecedented scale of disaster, of course. What has been the response, and specifically, Greg, in Central Florida, how are things going as far as getting food and supplies up there, and how is that sort of distribution network going? Because, you know, looking at some of the destruction to the roads and things, that must be quite challenging getting supplies to where it needs to go.
Yeah, definitely. And I can tell you that at Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida, as a networked member of Feeding America and Feeding Florida, are really working together with other food banks in Florida and certainly in the Panhandle to get that extra food where it needs to go, sort of in the order that it needs to get there and in a really, really coordinated way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from our response here in Central Florida, we've already managed to send about 3 tractor trailer loads full of packed boxes that volunteers have come into the food bank and put together. These are both the kind of immediate need boxes that contain pop-top cans and other things that don't need to be cooked necessarily and those types of things and MREs and all of those kinds of things. And those have already been up in the Panhandle for a while now after mm-hmm. the storm. But right now we're preparing for the long-term effect, and that's what the chief touched on in his comments, and that's mm-hmm. going to be coming up for many, many weeks and months even beyond where we are today. And so, you know, it's really important that people understand that, you know, 1 in 5 people needed help with food in the Panhandle before the storm, right? So everything that's happening now is on top of that need. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people who are needing food for the first time in their lives and don't know where to turn and that kind of thing. So it's important that as our community reaches out, that we remember that there are people everywhere that need that help. And hopefully we look at that in an over and above way rather than I'm gonna give in a different direction just because
there's crisis, right?
Right.
Greg Higgison with Second Harvest Food Bank of Central Florida. I want to hear from you as well. You can send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Have you been motivated to help out during the aftermath of this crisis, or maybe you're thinking about the things that you might be doing to help the community up in the Panhandle? We're at WMFE. You can send us your comments and questions on Twitter. Chief Michael Vita, I want to bring you back into the conversation if you're still with us. Just kind of thinking about what the response has been and what the needs are. Are you sort of seeing things like just a basic need for food and water from your teams going out there and talking to folks on the ground sort of in the midst of that destruction?
Yeah, so absolutely. The citizens in the area, you know, many of them have lost their shelter. You know, they're basically surviving on exactly what was just mentioned with canned food and bottled water and things like that as they begin to try to rebuild their properties and get some basic necessities dealt with. So there still is tremendous need mm-hmm. up in this area.
I want to bring Rebecca DeLorenzo in from the American Red Cross. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. The Red Cross has been pretty active, too, sort of in the response to this. First of all, I wonder if you could just give us a sense of what the sheltering need is and how the Red Cross is working with folks in need up there.
Sure. Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to join you guys today. Currently, it looks like we are still running about 12 shelters. 10 of those are managed by the Red Cross, and 2 of those we're supporting with shelter workers and feeding. So those counts haven't quite stabilized. People have been some individuals have been kind of sticking it out and hunkering down at home, but now it's been, 8-9 days that they've been there, and now we see those individuals coming to the shelter. But we also see some people that have been in shelters for several days that are going home and trying to get back to some kind of normalcy. So we're supporting those in about 3 districts that's covering the main counties that have the major affected areas, including Gulf. I'm just pulling up my map here to get them all correct. Bay, Washington counties, Gulf, Franklin, Jackson, Calhoun, Liberty, and Gadsden County.
Mm-hmm. Are you expecting, Rebecca DeLorenzo, that these shelters will be open for months? Is it going to be that sort of situation, or is there a kind of a finite time, do you think, that shelters, there'll be a need for them?
Where we're at right now, we don't have a timeline. We are traditionally, shelters are opened in schools, and as the schools are striving to get back to normal, we're assessing client needs and trying to pivot into other sheltering locations, and so that's a big focus for the past few days and moving forward for the next few days, is trying to determine the ongoing sheltering needs. But we do intend that we don't have a final date as of right now of how long these shelters are going to be open. It is going to be for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Greg Higgison, what about the sort of outlook for Second Harvest Food Bank? I mean, how long do you think you might need to be in this sort of the phase that you're in right now where you're sending up convoys of supplies?
Yeah, we expect it to be going on for months, Matthew. We, as I mentioned, are part of the Feeding America network, and as the national network of food banks, they have a really coordinated way of sort of marshaling that food wealth from all of the companies that they work with throughout the year for food donations, and can direct them to the affected areas in a very quick way and so on. And so in Central Florida, we're going to be serving as a really important staging point for food that's making its way into the state. And yeah, we'll have to send it back a little bit north, but it's important that all of those things don't arrive at once, in the affected areas, because they can't handle it all at once.
Is there a specific kind of thing that you need right now? Like you mentioned meals ready to eat, MREs.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have gotten quite a few of those through Feeding America and Feeding Florida. But what we need right now from the general public are donations of funds and also of non-perishable food items and cleaning supplies. So canned foods, non-perishable shelf-stable type items that we can box up and send to the Panhandle are much needed. We can collect those at our 3 sites here in Central Florida. And go online and figure out how to help, whether it's dollars or giving money, or giving food, rather.
Certainly. Orange County Fire Chief Michael Vite, I want to bring you back. I mean, there's a caravan of first responders from Central Florida heading back now. They've been deployed for some time now. What are you hearing from them?
So these are the folks who are really at the point of the spear. In fact, the hurricane winds were just subsiding when they made their way into the hurricane area. So they literally were walking in front of their vehicles, finding a clear path through the devastated roadways to get to these folks who had rode out and survived the storm. They are pretty heavily impacted by what they've witnessed. I can tell you that each and every one of them wanted to stay in theater when we were changing them out. They wanted to continue the work they were doing, but it was time for us to bring in some fresh crews. And they are tired, but really very humbled and very grateful to have been able to deliver the service that they provided.
Are some of them maybe going to just take a break for a day or two and then head back up? Is that the way it might work?
So what we do is we rehab them for several days. It's important to remember that they have been living in primitive conditions. A lot of these folks have slept in their vehicles or slept on the ground beside devastated fire stations. So we're going to let them get back to some normal life. They're going to have their first hot shower in a couple of weeks. And, I think a lot of them would love to come back and continue the mission.
Mm-hmm. And Rebecca De Lorenzo with the American Red Cross, what about the Red Cross workers? I'm sure some of them must be sort of experiencing the same conditions and maybe ready for a break. Would that be right?
Yeah, so typically our volunteers and our staff volunteer do two-week deployments. We like them to take, again, some time off. After 7 days, we cycle everybody off for a day, and then they can stay in the deployed area for up to 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks. And then we cycle them out. We ask them to take a full week off, and then if they want to come back out, we welcome them with open arms. But we're constantly getting fresh volunteers in every day, so we're rotating out our teams. Our shelter teams get rotated out more frequently than every 7 days, just because it's even though they're not working 24-hour shifts, they're basically on 24-hour shifts. So we like to get them breaks as frequently as possible.
Greg Higgison, there's a food bank that Second Harvest is involved with up in that area. Tell me a little bit about that and what the demand is at that food bank.
Yeah, right now there are two main food banks that we work with and that are in the affected areas. One is in Tallahassee, the Second Harvest of the Big Bend is what it's called. And then, of course, there's Feeding the Gulf Coast, which is in Bay County. And I can tell you that both of them are just, you know, it's an all-hands-on-deck situation up there. Everything that they're doing is on top of their normal need. And so they are moving enormous amounts of extra food through there on a daily basis. In addition to the food that we have sent north already, we've already sent some equipment, some pallet jacks and things like that that can help them in their warehousing and their distribution operations. And we've also sent staff north that have had some extensive experience in Hurricane Irma and, mm-hmm. and even in other disasters that we've worked with in the past, so that they can have those extra hands and some of that extra knowledge about how to handle the additional load.
Mm-hmm. Chief Michael Vida, I read last night that a Gulf County firefighter died when a tree fell on his tractor. His name is Brad Price. I'm wondering if that just kind of gives you a sense or what your sense is of just how dangerous this recovery effort is going to be, because people talk about, you know, in the aftermath of the storm, sometimes that is the most dangerous time. And you mentioned you're seeing chainsaw injuries and the like, but the risk to the first responders and firefighters, just give us a sense of what that's like. Are you still with us, Chief Vida? Sounds like we might have lost the chief there. But Rebecca De Lorenzo, I mean, is there a kind of a risk factor involved for the Red Cross workers on the ground up there?
As it relates to just working in the shelter, you know, we always send people out with teams, and we've been very careful. We've had a lot of support from everybody in the field as far as emergency services and stuff like that. So, I mean, we have had some hardship codes, you know, because people are sleeping in tents and staff shelters and that type of stuff. But we're all very aware and careful about taking care of ourselves and our clients.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Greg Higgison, you mentioned that there's a need for people to, you know, pitch in and help and organizations like yourselves, like the Red Cross and others, they always say, well, the best thing to do is don't send stuff, send, you know, give cash to an organization which has the resources to deal with something like this. What else can people do if they want to help? I mean, is there a way for them to go volunteer at centers like the one that you run here in Central Florida or elsewhere?
Yes, absolutely. Volunteering is a big part of it. We've used dozens of volunteers in the last week or so to put disaster boxes together at our distribution center here in Orlando. We always need more help as far as that goes. We have volunteer shifts that are available morning and afternoon during the week and also on Saturdays. And so I would suggest that if somebody has a few hours that they want to come down and help out, they can come to Second Harvest and look us up on feedhopenow.org to find out how to do that.
Greg Higgison with Second Harvest of Central Florida, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also, we were also joined by Rebecca De Lorenzo with the American Red Cross. Rebecca, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Orange County Fire Rescue Chief Michael Vida, thank you too. We also heard earlier in the program from Kate J with Verizon. Up next, Tammy Hicks and Miles Hicks join us for a conversation about their journey of faith, acceptance, and coming out. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Reformation Project is a Christian grassroots organization that promotes inclusion of LGBTQ people by reforming church teaching on sexual orientation and gender identity. The Reformation Project is in Orlando with its national conference this weekend. The conference kicked off last night, and two of the speakers are Tammy Hicks and Miles Hicks, a mother and son who are featured in the Netflix show Queer Eye. Well, Tammy Hicks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Miles, thank you as well.
All right. Thank you so much for having us.
Tell me a little bit about the Reformation Project. What exactly is it and how did you come to be involved in it?
Okay. The Reformation Project, it's a project that, you know, seeks to form an inclusive body of Christ. A body of Christ is not disjointed, where everybody is loved and has a role as far as fulfilling the mission of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And I came to be involved in the Reformation Project because I was a guest on the Netflix series Queer Eye, season 2, episode 1. And in that particular episode, I have very, very strict, you know, religious background. And I'm also the mother of a gay son. And during the process of growing spiritually and growing to learn to love my son as he is and accept him for who he is and for who God made him, the Queer Eye, they came and they chose me as a hero. And so from that, it just went to the world stage. And that's how, you know, I became affiliated with the Reformation Project, but I do believe in their mission.
Well, Miles, let me bring you into this conversation. What's this whole process been like for you? I mean, to kind of find acceptance both, you know, within the church and then from your mother as well?
Yeah, definitely been a challenge. The whole process has been a whirlwind because leading up to that, I actually have kind of a different story of how, like, where I came about, because I think they had found my mom and they talked to her and they asked her if there's any males, you know. That's how she came to be the first female hero. Mm-hmm. But they asked, are any males in our church need some work or in a rut or anything? And she recommended me because, you know, my life was like kind of a mess back then. Like right at that moment, I had just graduated college and didn't know what I wanted to do. And so that came along. And so when she mentioned me, I still had this idea that, like, I'm this fashionista, like, I don't need any help. I'm like, oh, okay, really? But the beautiful thing was, like, we didn't even ask, like, oh, can my mom be the hero? It was, they saw our relationship, how much we loved each other, so they just wanted to tap into that process of how, because it's so rare in the LGBT community that queer youth, like, have good connection with their parents, good relationship. And so they really respected that. And so that's how it came along for me, and it was, like, it didn't really click until June 15th when the actual show aired. I was just like, oh, it's just something we did, you know. I don't even know if it's real or not. Like, is this, like, process real? But it was definitely real from, like, you know, the reception from the whole world. And it's beautiful to see how many, you know, people message me every day thanking me. Like, I just think I'm an everyday regular guy, but people look at me as, you know, this hero because I represent the LGBT youth that have that good relationship with their mother and just prevailed. And that's the message I want to spread. Just stay steadfast in yourself, steadfast in your faith, and, you know, you will be okay.
Have you always had that relationship, that rapport with your mom?
No. The whole basis of the episode was, like, how we had such a tough relationship because we call it in the Black community churchy. Like, we were really churchy growing up, going to church, like, 5 days out of the 7 of the week, everything. And so I'm like, this was, you know, that was my whole life. But then when I came to terms, like, during my adolescent years, like, with me being gay, I didn't know it was such a big issue. And then I saw the reaction of my family and my peers in my church, and I was like, oh, wow. And so my mom didn't take it well either at first, you know. And so it was a whole process, just years long, you know, until college, where it was really just a lot of self-reflection on both of us, me and my mom, and just coming to terms with that acceptance that I'm still the beautiful person that she raised, which a lot of parents don't tap into that. They just look at this relationship as I'm the parent, you're the child, and you do what I say. But she really, that's why I love her so much, because her intellect and just capacity opened up so much, you know, because it came from a point of fear, and she didn't want me to be hurt, like me coming out. And so I really, like I said, appreciate, and a lot of a lot of LGBT youth don't have that relationship. And so, but yeah, it's been a struggle, but we got there. So,
Tammy, was there a point where you're like, I've got to make this work, or was it sort of more a slow process of accepting?
I knew I was torn. You know, here's my son, you know, that I love more than life. You know, a parent's love or a mother's love for a son or a daughter, you know, that is the closest thing that we as humans can see, you know, tangibly as the way God loves everybody. And so I was really torn in that I love God, but does that mean that I cannot love my son the way he is at the same time? In 2013, I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And within that process, because sometimes in going through things, we wonder, you know, we want to say, oh, it's what are people trying to do to me? What, God, what are you trying to do to me? What are people trying to do to me? And we don't introspect, you know. But my thing is always, God, what are you trying to teach me, you know, about this situation? And, you know, during the process of, you know, the cancer, and I had a lot of time to talk to God and to reflect, and he allowed me to see that I was on that journey, not only for myself, but for others. That was the main thing. And so God spoke to me one day, and it was that moment. A friend of mine asked me, she was like, was it a pebble moment? I was like, no, honey, that was a boulder. I was in my kitchen, and I could hear the God, voice of God so real. And he asked me this simple question, why can't you love the way I love? And I was like, oh, yes, God, I love you. Jesus, I love you. I love everybody. I pray for everybody. I feed the hungry. I do what you say to. You know, I love everybody. And then he spoke to me again. He said, well, why can't you love your son the way that I love your son?
What about your relationship with the church then? I mean, has that been tough as well? And are you still with the same church that you were with and, I guess, Miles, that you grew up going to?
Well, yeah, the as far as the relationship with the church, I would say right now at this particular point, it is stronger than ever. That was a church I grew up in Gay, Georgia. And I actually left when I, you know, I moved off to college. I'm like, okay, forget this God thing. Let me go out there and find myself and do what I want to do and bump everything else, you know. And so, but when I, later on, when I began to have children, you know, I found myself back, you know, at that same, you know, the same church. And that, during that particular, it was rocky during that process. But now, since the show and since, you know, everything has happened, I've always been a leader in the church. But I think people really see me now as a strong leader because they are actually taking my lead.
What about you, Miles? What are you going to be telling folks at this conference this weekend? What's the kind of message you're going to be putting out there?
Yeah, I give a side as I speak for those little kids that don't have a voice, because I went through that. And like I was saying to someone earlier, how, you know, our generation is our trailblazers for that. You know, like back in civil rights movement, you had trailblazers for race and but sexuality and like just breaking those walls and barriers. Like, we're the generation that will achieve that ultimately. And so I feel like myself is representative as of that youth that couldn't speak, you know, and what you could be and what you could do. And so that's why I want the whole, like, aura to be at the Reformation Project and the conference, that, you know, it better days will come. And, like, this is a product of, me and all are a product of what can happen.
Well, Miles Hicks and Tammy Hicks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tammy Hicks and Miles Hicks are in Orlando with the Reformation Project's National Conference. They're speaking at the United Methodist Church on East Jackson Street this evening. Up next, music from the Ozarks. Intersections back in a minute.
Round and round you turn here in my arms.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Last December, a trio of musicians, Chris Blevins, Paddy Cannoli, and Caleb McGee, visited WMFE to perform and talk with Intersection's Brendan Byrne about the Ozark sound. Chris Blevins kicked off the performance with a song called Love for the Lonely.
Last night I had a dream we were dancing round and round you turn here in my arms. Oh, and every ugly face I ever knew was in that place seemed so happy when I woke up with you gone. This morning I took sugar in my coffee, bittersweet the way you'd always do. I went out to meet my day, thought on what you might say. If you could see the sorry way I'm missing you. Yeah, I wish you could see me now. Yeah, I hope I made you proud. Yeah, I just wanna feel you hold me. Don't cry for the dead, pray for the living and love for the lonely. Lay me down beneath the willow at my evening's end. Sing me sweetly homeward to that sky. Give me one last view, some sweet memory of you. God, just take this worry from my eyes. I wish you could see me now. Hope I've made you proud. I just wanna feel you hold me. Don't cry for the dead, pray for the living and love for the lonely. Last night I had a dream that we were dancing.
Well, that's Chris Blevin on guitar there from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Chris, how would you describe the kind of music you folks are playing?
Well, Oklahoma's kind of become an amalgam state as far as music goes. So, I mean, there's different pieces to a lot of different genres. I think I'm probably lean a little more towards country than a lot of folks up there do. Definitely a lot more than these two do. But yeah, I don't know. Elements of soul, country. It was a pretty prominent phase in like the 60s and 70s called the Tulsa Sound. Guys like Leon Russell, you know, things like that. And yeah, I pull a lot from that. But yeah, that's how I describe me anyway.
Patty Cannoli, let me bring you in on the conversation. Patty, you're a transplant from Oklahoma, recently moved here to Lakeland. What's the main difference between the music scene in Oklahoma and here in Central Florida?
So right before I left, I was just now getting involved in music in Tulsa with Chris, and the community there seemed pretty tight knit. I hadn't really delved into it as much, so I guess I don't have much of a contrast to decipher. But in Lakeland, there's a small like art community there, and it's kind of like the same group of people who contribute musically and artistically and like small business wise. But everybody's so very supportive of each other, and everyone like encourages each other to work together. And like if someone's having an opening, the musicians come play music for their opening, and then you can post your art up there. Like everyone is just completely working together. It's on a smaller scale, like as opposed to maybe like St. Pete or something. Like I've been out there a couple of times, and it just seems like there's a lot more avenues. But in Lakeland, it's like I couldn't ask for anything more. Everyone's so supportive.
Would you mind playing a little something for us, Patty?
Oh, sure, sure.
Great, take it away. Patty Cannoli on banjo and vocals there. Let's bring Caleb in on the conversation now. Caleb, Chris said you play a little bit of a different style than he does. How would you describe your sound and your influences?
There's a lot of blues and old school kind of R&B in mine. I just grew up listening to that stuff, and I've always loved it. Roots rock and roll, I guess. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that in there, too.
Caleb McGee, would you mind playing us out?
I'd be glad to.
What are you going
to
play for us?
This is one of mine. This song is called Pensioner's Blues.
That's Caleb McGee on guitar and vocals, and we've also been speaking with Chris Blevins and Patty Cannoli. But take it away, Caleb.
Thank you. Well, he was 2 years out from his pension when the factory said they didn't need his shit anymore. Yes, he was 2 years out from his pension when the factory said they didn't need his shit anymore. Was a cost-saving measure put in place by men who'd never been hungry before. Yes, the CEO made himself a fortune, went out and bought himself a brand new yacht. Then the CEO made himself a fortune, went out and bought himself a brand new yacht. All the men on third shift wanted was that monthly pension that they earned in that gold watch. Making pause. Now he's holding on just as tight as he can. He spent 38 long years making pause. Now he's holding on just as tight as he can. Oh, that's always the first thing that happens. We make a machine to take the job of a man.
And that was Caleb McGee with a track called Pensioner's Blues. You also heard from Chris Blevins and Paddy Cannoli performing and talking to 90.7's Brendan Byrne. And that interview first aired last December. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance for today's show from Abe Abariah, Danielle Pryor, and Emily Lang. You can find us on the NPR One app, download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts, and check us out on Spotify. We're in our fall silent drive. We're counting on listeners like you to keep local programs like Intersection on the air. Become a sustaining member and we'll send you a thank you gift, a pair of custom WMFE socks. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.